Welcome back to the Expert Witness Playbook, the podcast where we talk with physicians and legal professionals about the craft of medical expert witness work, how it's done, how to do it well, how to navigate the real-world challenges of practicing at the intersection of medicine and law. I'm your host, Dr. Brian Woodruff, pediatric neurologist and medical expert witness. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Stephen Cohen, a board-certified general and colorectal surgeon with more than three decades of clinical and academic experience. Dr. Cohen has spent much of his career teaching and mentoring medical students and surgical residents, while also building an extensive career as a medical expert witness. Over the years, he has participated in more than 200 depositions and over 30 trial appearances, giving him a deep perspective on what works, what doesn't, when physicians step into the legal arena. He's particularly known for his ability to break down complex surgical issues in a way that juries can easily understand, which is a critical skill for any effective expert witness. Today we'll talk about his path into expert work, lessons learned from hundreds of depositions, and what physicians should know if they're considering doing this kind of work themselves. Dr. Cohen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here.
Yeah, this is great. We're kind of getting into the interview season. We did a lot of sort of lectures, but I'm really enjoying getting to talk with people, and so this has really been fun. I think we should just dive in. Let's start to talk about, you know, how you got into expert work, you know, how you got involved. So just take it away.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So I actually, my first year in practice in 1994, was asked by my senior partner if I was willing to look at a case. I didn't even know what that meant. I didn't know you get paid for it. I didn't know what the process was. But he had a conflict with another surgeon. And so I reviewed the case and I enjoyed it. I mean, for me, you know, in my years of teaching, training, and educating medical students and residents, this is the same thing, right? Because we're talking to attorneys, we're talking to the court, we're talking to juries. They don't understand medicine or why we do what we do. So from my first review, it just seemed to grow from there, word of mouth, other attorneys. They liked my honest opinions. The plaintiff attorneys appreciated when I told them that this was just a bad outcome. It was not a breach in the standard of care. And attorneys just want to know the science of what we do and why we do it.
The really good attorneys, the really good plaintiff attorneys really want to be told no. Because you tell me what your experience has been, but they do not want to go down the course of spending a lot of money on a case that isn't very meritorious. Have you kind of found that same?
Well, so I just recently last week got off the phone with a plaintiff attorney who filed the case because he talked to his friend who was a general surgeon, not an expert witness. And he told him, based on what he heard, that it's definitely a breach in the standard of care, filed the case, spent a lot of money and time and resources to get the information, but then he looked to hire an expert. So I reviewed the case, and it was clearly just a bad outcome and not a breach in the standard of care. And that happens, unfortunately, that if you do this kind of work, you have to be the kind of physician that does what you're opining on, actively in practice, and you have to use evidence-based medicine like we do every day, taking care of patients, to opine on what happened and why it happened. And he was unhappy with me, but he did thank me at the end because now he can stop.
Yeah. Maybe he'll stop. Maybe he'll end up hiring somebody else to see if, you know, you often wonder if they go off and hire somebody else. But I sleep well knowing that that I've given people my honest opinion, whether they like it or not, and we move on. And so you got that first case, and then did you sort of actively pursue more, or did you sort of passively kind of how did that work after that point? Because that sort of got you going. You're like, oh, this is cool.
Right. So the first
there are a lot of docs out there that sort of may have had one and they don't know what to do at that point. Do you active? Do you passive? Like, where do you go from there?
Well, so what I did the first, so I've been in the private sector for 23 years. And then I came as an academic surgeon at the VA Medical Center. And that's where I am now in Richmond. But for the first 20 years, I was much more passive. We had a busy 9-person practice, 7 offices, 50 employees. I was doing 50 cases a week. I mean, I was busy with all the anorectal and colonoscopy and the colectomies. So it really, for the first 15, 20 years, it was much more passive. It was word of mouth. I'd get asked periodically 4 or 5 cases a year to review. I wasn't really actively pursuing it. When I switched from private practice to academics, at that point, I had more time and I really pursued it more, either using LinkedIn. But the other thing that I did was, you know, getting in front of legal nurse consultants to teach, train, educate that group of individuals. Because again, a lot of attorneys, you know, if you're an attorney sitting in Omaha, Nebraska, and a patient comes in and they think they have a claim, how do they know to find experts, right? They can go online, which is, that's hit or miss. There's a lot of third parties out there that will take the money for the expert to find them. That's not a great system. Most of them will still go word of mouth. But getting in front of legal nurse consultants, to me, really then elevated the number of cases I was asked to review, both on the plaintiff and the defense. Initially, I was probably doing more defense work for the first 20 years, but as words got out, and I remember being in a defense deposition, and 6 months later, that plaintiff attorney called and asked me, and I didn't remember him, but I said, well, how did you find me? He said, well, you were against me and we knew that you were a good witness and we couldn't win this case. So now we want you on our side if you think it's a breach in the standard of care. So those things, just as the years went on, the passive grew. And then I became a little bit more active in marketing myself, explaining to either on LinkedIn or to other avenues like the legal nurse consultant groups that I'm available to review the cases.
So, tell me what avenues or what route would somebody take to get in front of the legal nurse consultants? Like, what if there are people out there listening right now saying, okay, Steve, what do I do to do what you just did?
Yeah, so there's a couple of issues with that. Number one, there are attorneys that may not hire me because I advertise my services, right? Probably the biggest advertising that all of us do is on a company called Seek, S-E-A-K. They've been around for 30 plus years. They're the best, and they're just an intermediary for attorneys to go on and find people. But there are attorneys, right? There are attorneys that will not hire me because I market myself, and that's fine. But the way I look at it is that as an attorney, you better find an expert that is an expert in the field, that's still active in practice, that knows all the tricks that the other side uses, as you know. And I say this all the time, and I have so many examples that I could talk about. For us, you know, we take care of patients, we do the right thing, we have complications, we deal with them. To them, it's a game, right? It's a game. Why do I say it's a game? It's a game because if they can win on a technicality, they're going to win, right? So for them, they look at it a little different than we do. The legal nurse consultant, the biggest group out there is AALNC, American Association of Legal Nurse Consultants. They have an annual meeting. They probably have about 6 or 7 local chapters throughout the country. They do monthly webinars. They're looking for experts that they can use, and getting in front of them and letting them hear you talk and explaining what the incidence of a leak is and why we worry about that and what CAT scan is appropriate to find the leak, right? Or in an anorectal case, even though you have a bad outcome with a hemorrhoidectomy, did the patient undergo medical therapy? Did they follow the right algorithm to get to surgery? And if they had a complication, was it recognized in a timely fashion? So AALNC is the biggest one. There's a couple of offshoots that have started in the last couple of years, ARC, Attorneys Resource Conference. They have a yearly conference in the summertime that's located in Michigan.
Yeah, right in my hometown. It's in Grand Rapids. Yeah.
Right. So this year, I think the meeting is in Grand Rapids, and I'm giving a talk for that one. Are you giving a talk?
I live here, so when you come to town, we'll have to do dinner. Okay. Absolutely.
So
yeah, dinner's
so
on me.
They're growing by leaps and bounds. The person running it used to be part of AALNC. She wanted to start her own group. This year is going to be a lot of attorneys there. So attorneys and experts can talk about different issues. So it's really a good conference that we can partner with attorneys so we can explain to them how we think, why we do what we do, and help them navigate either defending or prosecuting their case.
So I've heard you bring up a couple things. SEEK as a directory, it's been around forever. It's probably the most, from what I understand, probably the most used, the most extensive. Are you listed on there?
I am listed on there. I've been listed on there for a long time.
Yeah.
Sometimes I don't know where the case comes from, right? So I don't always know it comes from SEEK. I usually don't ask where it comes from. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. Certainly in deposition, I always get asked that question, as you know. How did this attorney find you? I don't remember. There's no way I can remember. Nothing happens quick in the medical legal world. By the time I'm getting deposed, it may be 2 years when I first got this charge.
Absolutely. Everything.
So,
do you have a website, Steve?
So I do have a website that's just a landing page. That's all
kind
it
of
is. Just
an electronic business card, basically.
That's all it really is. I'm not a big believer in the website per se. I mean, that can cause some issues of having a website and marking yourself on the web. I use LinkedIn. I mean, some people use that, but the website thing has always been a question mark for me.
Tell me about LinkedIn. Have you found that you've made some good connections on LinkedIn?
Yeah, actually, it's been good. Certainly, a lot of legal nurse consultants use LinkedIn, and I've been asked, you know, curbside consults. I get asked those a lot, probably a couple of times a week. Just, what do you think? Do you think there's any merit to this case? So I do that. Attorneys don't usually use LinkedIn to find experts, but definitely the legal nurse consultant world do use LinkedIn. That's kind of their foray into trying to market themselves to let attorneys know that they can do chronologies and they can opine on standard of care of nurses. So for legal nurse consultants, they use it a lot.
So that's another avenue outside of contacting AALNC or ARC. Kind of reaching out to them for their conferences, kind of connecting in through LinkedIn. Yeah, let's shift gears into deposition experience. Obviously, you've done over 200 depositions. And you and I both get to read a lot of depositions. What do you think are the biggest mistakes that you see physicians make during depositions?
Yeah, that's a great question. So certainly on the defense side is, I've been sued 5 times and I've been deposed in my own cases. When you're emotionally involved in the case, it's very difficult, right? Because when you get named in a lawsuit, you're told by everybody, you can't talk to anybody. You can't talk to your mentors. Don't talk to anybody about the case, right? The biggest mistake I see on the defense side is, allowing the opposing counsel plaintiff to get you to agree that knowing the outcome, you would have done something different.
Okay.
Right? So I was in a case, I was trying to defend another colorectal surgeon who did a very routine outpatient anorectal procedure. It was a 15-minute operation. The patient was on blood thinner. He appropriately stopped it for 5 days. The INR was normal at the time of surgery, 15-minute prone jackknife case. The patient woke up and had a stroke. Bad outcome, terrible outcome. He had a bad deficit. The last question that surgeon was asked in defense of his case was, doctor, knowing what you know now, would you do something different? And as a physician, he said, of course I would. I might not have operated. I might have done something different. And that's the only reason why the jury found against the doctor, because the jury foreman said, because the doctor said he would have done something different, that's a problem. That's not the answer. And I say this all the time. Outcome is irrelevant in standard of care. We can do everything right. You can have a bad outcome. A much better answer would have been, no, I didn't. The chance of a stroke is low. I met the standard of care by stopping the Coumadin, and that's how I defended him. I would not have done this. No reasonable, prudent surgeon would have done this operation on Coumadin. The chance of a stroke is so low, less than 1%. He was on it for AFib, but it's a bad outcome, not a breach in the standard of care.
Yeah. What about, that's if you're a defendant. What about, what do you see as sort of experts, where experts get into trouble in depositions?
Well, where experts get into trouble in depositions is not knowing the chart, the dates, the times. If you go into a deposition on the play, whatever side you're on, you need to know that chart better than the opposing counsel.
Preparation.
The preparation that I do for a deposition is more than I do for a trial, right? Because in trial, they're going to go through my deposition. The trial to me is easy. The deposition is the hard part, because a lot of times, and I tell this to my colleagues as well, it's not always what you answer, but it's how you answer it. You can't be defensive about your fees. You can't be defensive about your marketing. You have to know the dates, the times, what the issues were, exactly when the patient became septic. Exactly. You need to put yourself in the place of the doctor at the time, not knowing the outcome, what standard of care would have been. And the ones that don't take this serious enough don't have the chart memorized, don't know all the details, and they don't do a good job, whatever side they're on.
No, I totally agree. As someone who's been, we have pretty similar numbers. I've probably been in about 250 depositions and about 30 trials. And you know, I think the big things that I see are physicians that overtalk when they answer the question and then they keep talking. And that attorney on the other side just stays quiet. Like, come on, just keep talking. And they create problems for themselves, or because they say things that they think are not, or they think are benign. So I always tell people, keep answers concise. Just answer the question.
Right. The other thing is opining outside your lane.
Oh, staying in your lane.
If I get asked about life expectancy, I have no opinion. And it's okay to say you have no opinion, right? It's I'm opining on the standard of care of a surgeon who is taking care of this patient. Life expectancy, no opinion.
Yeah.
Certainly, if the patient died, I can easily say more likely than not, the death would have been prevented. But how long they live, that's not up to me.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. I think I see keeping answers concise, staying calm, and not getting emotional.
It's easier said than done.
I can never understand why experts decide they want to argue with an attorney, or, you know, and that when I'm reading a deposition, I'm always surprised at when people start to argue. And but staying in your lane, because I've seen experts that had great opinions and very well founded, like did very well, but they went outside of their lane and they basically blew it entirely for them because they extended beyond and they were no longer perceived as being objective. They looked like an advocate at that point.
Well, that's the problem. See, the problem with physicians is we don't know the law. We know medicine. They know the law. So the other side is trying to listen to anything that they can get to go back to the court to say, this expert should be excluded because he said 1, 2, 3, and that's not, you know? So those are the things that you learn as you go along the way. Stick to the medicine. You don't know the law. Don't try to figure out why they're asking you the question. That's a mistake I made early. I was trying to be three steps ahead of the attorney, but that's not my role, right?
Right. Your job's not there to win the case.
Right. And that's what I tell
people. I always
people.
Tell it's people not, that.
It's not my case. Were you hired to give the opinion that the attorney asked for? No, I was hired to give my opinion based on a reasonable, prudent physician, knew at the time and should have known at the time that would have prevented the bad outcome or prevented
exactly.
the complication.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Being objective, avoiding being an advocate, and being honest.
Yeah, because I say all the time, the win is not up to me. It's up to the jury. Either you guys settle the case, and that's up to you all, or it's up to the jury. I'm just explaining to them the medicine, and I need to explain to them in a way that makes mechanistic and physiologic sense.
Well, I think that's a good segue into sort of trials. When you're teaching the jury at a trial, which I love. I love that.
That's the most fun.
It is. And especially if I get to stand up and they allow you to go down and you got a big
easel.
Board or a big post-it note board or something. Yeah. So what is your way of connecting with the jury and explaining things? Cause colorectal surgery is pretty darn, it's complicated. Similar to pediatric neurology. And what are some of your techniques that you use to teach?
So first of all, you have to make it simple. So you have to remember that it's not really a jury of our peers, right? It's not their fault, but the system is set up where they maybe have an eighth grade education and you never know the background that the juries are bringing. I mean, I've had cases where it's a clear breach in the standard of care. Yet the jury found for the doctor, and their conclusion was because the attorney asked the jury foreman, why did you it was a breach in the standard of care, why did you find in favor of the doctor? They said, oh no, we knew it was a breach in the standard of care, but he was the only doctor in the area. We didn't want to lose him, right? So the truth doesn't always matter in the court of law. You know, I try to connect with the jury. Colorectal surgery, we have a lot of jokes. So if you start out with a few jokes, that always helps. definitely getting off the stand is the most important thing. And every trial I go, when we're prepping for the trial, I always ask for an easel or some kind of demonstrative. One of the things when I'm talking about adhesion formation and what the tissue is like, it's hard to explain that to a jury, right? So I have done this before in a trial. I take two pieces of Kleenex dry and I say, this is what it looks like in your normal body. I can pull apart the Kleenex and it doesn't break. But then I dip it in water, put them together. And can you imagine me trying to pull these two pieces of Kleenex apart without tearing it? That's what it's like in surgery. So most of us are visual learners. If they have a visualization, I usually draw a picture of the colon, I show the appendix, I show the small bowel. So those things I think are really important for the jury to understand. Because the way I look at it, that's no different than me teaching the third year medical students. I have to do the same thing to them. So for me, it's like I'm teaching the medical students.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You talked about difference between deposition and trial. There probably are listeners out there that have had deposition but haven't been to trial. And there are some out there that are just starting to get cases that haven't been to deposition or trial. What is the biggest difference between deposition and trial? What do you see as the biggest difference? Because you're under oath, you're there with sworn testimony, but you know, tell our listeners sort of the difference between the two.
Well, in deposition, it's a one-sided adversarial conversation. It's fighting. You're explaining the medicine based on what you know, based on your education, experience, and training, and the other side doesn't believe anything you say, right? So it's a much more adversarial conversation. They're gonna ask you three questions at once and want you to answer yes or no. They're gonna try to put you in a box. They're going to try to limit your testimony. They're thinking of what their plan is, and they're looking at you. And again, it's not what you answer, it's how you answer it, because they're thinking, what's this guy going to look like in front of a jury? When you're finally in trial, remember, half of it is a friendly conversation, because you start with the direct questions. Dr. Cohen, where did you train? Tell the jury about yourself. I talk about my upbringing. My dad's a surgeon. My mom's a school teacher. I've been teaching and training. And you go through step by step of the case, what happened. So the first half of it is very easy, right? Because it's your side asking you questions to explain to the jury what happened. Then the cross-examination comes. But what I have found, and you probably found the same thing, they basically stick to the deposition. They really can't ask you a lot outside what they've already asked you. There's no new opinions that are coming up. You've already explained to the jury, but they try to take one or two sentences out of your deposition to make you say something different in court. So going into trial, you have to have your deposition memorized, right?
Absolutely.
So you have to know that deposition backwards and forwards, and then it becomes much easier, because they'll take one sentence out and say, well, Dr. Cohen, didn't you say this? And say, counselor, can I read? Because I know we talked about it for about 15 minutes. Let me see the transcript so I can explain to the jury what we were talking about. And they don't want you to do that, obviously, but having it memorized definitely will make you a better expert, more credible, and be able to bond better with the jury.
Yeah. I also find that even though cross-examination is adversarial, it's people are on their best behavior because there's a judge sitting in that room.
Right. It's a little bit different because they could be, and I've had very mean attorneys during the deposition, and they're not so mean during trial because the jury's looking at them too. And all of us have watched TV and trials and everything. And if they're acting like an idiot, the jury's going to see that. Right. So it's a very different interaction. But definitely for anybody that's listening that wants to get in this work or is thinking about it or hasn't done it much, this is what I tell the residents when they hear me talking about cases. If you're going to do this kind of work, you have to be able to sit in a room across, and you've probably done this, across from a physician that's board certified like you, that is trained like you, that has done as many or more of the same cases as you, look at them in the eye and tell them they fell below the standard of care. Not everybody can do that. You're not credible if you just do defense work. Defense work's fun, right? I can't defend everybody, but defense work is fun. But you can't be credible if you only do one side. And if you can't be in the same room of another doctor with those same credentials and tell them they fell below the standard of care, you shouldn't do this kind of work.
Yeah. No, it's true. I think people need to understand that it does come up where the defendant doctor is coming. If you are a standard of care, and I don't do a lot of standard of care because I'm mostly causation and damages, but in standard of care cases, the defendant doctor has the right to be there and often is there, and to be able to stare you down and so I think that's something that people need to understand.
So now because of COVID, everything has gone to Zoom, as you know. But before COVID, there was no Zoom depositions. I did 100% of my depositions before COVID in person, and many, many, many times, unbeknownst to me, which didn't matter because I have thick skin, they walked in the room and they're sitting right next to me. And they can't ask you questions, but their hands are folded. And if they could kill me with their eyes, I would be dead already. I mean, there is no doubt. But stick to the medicine. You're just opining on standard of care, but you have to be able to do that. And not all physicians can do that.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's a very, it can be a very adversarial. And I had several physicians come up to me and they said, because they know I've done expert witness work, and they said, I did one deposition and I will never do that again in my life. That was the worst experience I've ever had. It's certainly, you have to understand what you're getting into. There's preparation. There's the ability to be able to have difficult conversations with people. If you don't like confrontation, you don't want to be in this at all, because I always explain depositions are sort of like playing dodgeball with your hands tied behind your back with a blindfold that's almost over your eyes. And, or the other analogy that I use, it's an oral final examination. It's open book. But you really need to know what's going on. And the professor wants you to fail.
Yeah.
You know
exactly
what I mean? That's really it. You know, the professor, unlike in college where they want you to do well. So for physicians thinking about doing expert work, what separates, you know, we're kind of coming here towards the end, but and I really appreciate you taking the time. I think we got another one in the future. I feel like we just started a conversation, and we're going to have to, you and I have a lot of overlap. We could probably have our own podcast, the two of us, and just be bantering once a week over our beverage of choice. But so for physicians thinking about doing expert work, what separates a good expert from a bad one? Give me a couple nuggets.
Well, I think the biggest nugget is you have to be willing to spend the time to review the chart. And it does take a lot of time. You know, with the electronic medical record now, sometimes 15, 20,000 pages of records, and you have to go page by page. You have to put yourself in the place of the physician and really understand the medicine. And you have to understand a lot of it because, you know, a lot of these cases that I review on standard of care, the cardiologist saw the patient, the pulmonary doctor saw the patient, the infectious disease saw the patient, the critical care, yet I'm still opining they all fell below the standard of care. Well, I'm not an infectious disease doctor. I'm opining on the surgeon. I want the infectious disease doctor to order the antibiotics. They don't decide to do surgery. Cardiologist manages the heart, right? We kind of are all in our little silos, but you have to be willing, if you're going to do this job as a good expert, you have to be clinically active in that field, and you have
Absolutely.
To be willing to put in the time to give the attorney, whatever side you're on, your opinion based on everything in the chart. And I think with time, attorneys are going to get smarter. Attorneys are going to get smarter. Why is that? There's something called AI now, and there's a lot of good AI programs out there now that attorneys can upload the chart. It's HIPAA compliant. They can put, you know, what standard of care. It reaches out to the literature. So you have to know it better than they do, right? I mean, there's definitely nothing that beats education, experience, and training. Everything in the literature obviously is not authoritative. It's based on that one article. You could find an article to defend your side anywhere in the literature. That's easy. But it's really spending the time to give the attorneys what they need to either defend or prosecute their case. And that's the thing when I emphasize to my colleagues that want to get into this, a lot of them don't want to spend the time. Why? Because they're busy doing their clinical job. And I get that. But you can't do it half part. If you do it half time, it's not going to be beneficial to you. You're going to have an experience in deposition where I'm not doing this again. And probably your friend told you that because he didn't have the chart memorized and he was asked questions he didn't know. Right.
Yeah.
And that's that. And I learned that the hard way, too, where I didn't have it memorized and the attorney did. Right. So you need to know that chart better than the attorney.
So what is one piece of advice you would wish someone had given you before your first deposition? For those out there that next week they've got their first deposition, what's something that you wish you would have been told?
Well, I'll go back to you have to have that chart memorized. You have to go back. You have to have the chart memorized. If you have the chart memorized, meaning exact, you know, what was the white count at each day? What antibiotics was the patient on? When did the nurse start the pressors? What time? Right. You need to have all that at your fingertips. Now, again, even though they say they don't make it a memory test, they make it a memory test. Because if you say, well, I'm not sure, I'll have to go look at the chart. Well, you have 20,000 pages. You're not going to do that on the fly. So that's the thing that I've learned the hard way as each deposition went along to really understand what happened. And if you have the dates and the times memorized, you will shine in terms of whatever side you're on, for sure.
Yeah. Well, this has been awesome, and I appreciate. And we will definitely schedule another time. Feel like we were somewhere between first and second gear. We got into second gear, and I think we got a couple more gears for that's the Michigan side, the automotive side. We're just moving through some gears here, but yeah, it was great talking with you, I think this is where we're going to wrap up. So, Dr. Cohen, thank you for joining us and for sharing your perspective and experience from so many years working with attorneys and being in the surgical and expert witness world. For physicians interested in doing expert work, I think one of the key takeaways from today's conversation is the importance of clarity, credibility, and preparation, especially when you're explaining complicated medical issues to attorneys, judges, and juries who may have no medical background. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the Expert Witness Playbook and share it with colleagues who may be interested in medical legal consulting. And as always, if you're a physician doing expert work or thinking about getting started, we're always interested in hearing your story. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Expert Witness Playbook.